Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Friday, April 17, 2020. Producing from his own studio in Connecticut, Taylor Schwenk. And I'm Buster Olney, and I'm working from my home studio just north of New York City. Well, today in the podcast, it's the continuation of our Hall of Fame week, and we'll be talking about fear. So you know we'll be talking with Randy Johnson, the big unit, who joins us to talk about some iconic moments in his career, including that moment when he threw the ball over the head of John Kruk in the All-Star game. First, some news and notes. A league-wide initiative by all 30 major league clubs and over 50 major league players has raised nearly $1 million, providing over 4 million meals to support childhood hunger prevention in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. With schools shut down, players personally reached out to each other to collect donations as part of the Home Plate Project, a partnership between Major League Baseball, Garth Brooks, Brooks's Teammates for Kids Foundation, and Big League Impact, which was founded by St. Louis pitcher Adam Wainwright and is currently led by Wainwright and Texas Rangers pitcher Kyle Gibson. So good on them. Good news about Webster Garrison, a minor league manager in the Oakland Athletics system. He has resumed breathing completely on his own for the first time in more than 3 weeks and no longer requires a ventilator as he fights the coronavirus. According to his fiance, Garrison, 54, was hospitalized in his home state of Louisiana, hasn't yet started speaking when Nikki Trudeau posted her latest update on Thursday. Now, before we get to Randy Johnson and our chief executive, our weekly quiz, Todd Radom, just a reminder, there are plenty of ESPN podcasts to binge listen over the weekend. This week, there were new podcasts of the Bill Barnwell Show, the Adam Schefter podcast, First Draft, the College Football Podcast, Courtside with Greenberg and Dokich, and lots of great storytelling from ESPN Daily. Find them all wherever you get your podcast. So we're going to ask Randy Johnson about when he obliterated a bird in a spring training game and about this moment when he scared the heck out of John Kruk in the 1993 All-Star game. Give a listen.
John Kruk fanning himself off. Johnson has had pitches clocked at as much as 102 miles per hour in Major League play.
Now, this ball obviously just getting away from him, but watch the reaction of John Kruk. Would you say his heart is palpitating a bit?
When the second half resumes on Thursday.
Look at the next step. I don't blame John one bit on his right leg.
He failed out again at the breaking ball.
He wants no part of Randy Johnson. None.
Isn't this kind of response?
I don't think so. You knew that was coming. John had no chance.
And Johnson works a 1-2-3 inning.
Randy Johnson was inducted into Baseball's Hall of Fame in 2015. Randy, thanks for joining our Hall of Fame week and helping to distract us at a time when baseball fans are starved for a distraction.
I'm just sitting at my desk and doing what I've pretty much done. Training has ended. Just kind of waiting for the world to start up again. And I think baseball and sports and things like that are obviously kind of low on the totem pole. The last really tragic thing that I've been through was 9/11, being in the World Series, and obviously baseball was put on hold. But then eventually, when the World Series took place, I think it was, I guess, depending upon who you asked or the way I felt was, it was kind of a good thing for the people to be able to kind of bond to and kind of have that 3 or 4 hour time that they could kind of get away from other things on TV that, you know, were overwhelming at that time. So obviously I'm hoping that this, you know, comes to an end and we can get some form of normalcy back in our society again.
Oh, no question, which is, you know, part of the reason why we've been doing on the podcast lately, we've been having these great conversations, a lot of storytelling You know, this week has been Hall of Fame week. We talked with Johnny Bench and Mike Messina and Jim Palmer and George Brett, people you know from your time at the Hall of Fame. You know, I was going back at over your resume today, you know, 303 career wins, 4,875 strikeouts, all the Cy Young Awards, three times you finished second. And I got to tell you, as I get older, I would have guessed that as I get older, I'd care less about this stuff. But I also look at the fact that 15 people didn't vote for you.
Buster, that's my job.
Yeah, but yeah. 15 people didn't vote for you. And I recently we saw Mariano Rivera get in unanimously. And then this year, someone didn't vote for Derek Jeter. And we're all wondering, how could you not vote for Jeter? How could 15 people not vote for you? Right? I mean, should it bother me less?
I don't think so. I don't think it bothered anybody else at the time. I think, you know, the only people in my baseball career after I got inducted, realizing that nobody had been inducted unanimously, the only people that I was truly ever thinking about that possibly could be for my generation or while I'm alive would be Mariano Rivera, and he did. And then obviously not knowing what would happen with Derek Jeter, but thinking he could go in unanimously too. But there's been so many great ball players before all of us that, you know, a lot of the time, a lot of us didn't even go in. A lot of them didn't even go in on the first ballot. So I'm just happy to be there. And I don't think I lost any sleep not knowing who the 15 people were.
Increasingly, hey, I do. Maybe
did,
I'm just
did you
getting
vote?
Old.
You weren't one of those, were you?
No. I think that was. I think actually your ballot was the last year I voted. I stopped voting because I didn't like some of the new rules that came in place at the Hall of Fame. But that's when you look at your resume, it's like, of course you're going to get all the votes. And you didn't, and it, you pointed out that, you know, Joe DiMaggio didn't get in on his first year. Jackie Robinson got less than 80%. Jackie Robinson. Yeah. So anyway,
yeah, I'm not really sure, you know, quite frankly, I feel that that's a great responsibility, to have a vote, just like voting for the president. You know, obviously everybody that is a registered American has that ability. And obviously there's not as many people that can vote for the Hall of Fame. But if you do have that vote and you do have the ability to cast a vote for players to be elected into the Hall of Fame, I think your vote truly does matter because it could be significant in getting over that threshold of finally getting elected if you're on the bubble. So just my opinion after being inducted, I tend to hear a lot more about how the whole system kind of works. So it's kind of interesting to me.
I wanted to ask you about fear, about batters' fear. And in the time that I, you know, was covering baseball when you were pitching, I would hear that a lot from hitters about you, especially left-handed hitters. And I'm curious about sort of the first time as you're growing up, an amateur early in your professional career, how when you got the sense that that was something that was going to work for you, Randy.
I honestly believe that it wasn't fear like, oh my God, I got to face him. I think the fear kind of stemmed from early in my career, oh my God, this guy throws 100 miles an hour and he doesn't even know where it's going. That kind of fear, you know what I mean? Where I could literally throw a ball to the backstop and then, you know, put three pitches on the black and not know how to do that again the next batter. It just, the inconsistencies, I think, you know, velocity back when I played seemed to be more of a topic, more more interesting for someone to watch a power pitcher back then when I played the game, opposed to now, because I think everybody throws, you know, 95 to 100 miles an hour. You know, you got at least one or two starting pitchers that does that, and then you got bullpen people that come in after the starter that so there's really no discrepancy in velocity throughout the course of the game. Whereas when I played, it could be me in the rotation and then, you know, someone that, you know, is more known for a sinker or more known for a cutter or throws about 3 or 4 miles an hour on average less than I do. But in today's game, I think there's more velocity in the game. And I think whether it's starting pitcher or a reliever, I think it's just more in the game now. It's more prevalent than it was back when I pitched. And I think people feared the velocity more back then, and the wildness, the two, I think, you know, went hand in hand, because after a while, you know, I was able to harness my control. And then I think there was less, fear of getting hit because I had more control over the location of where I was throwing the pitches.
And I think it was the angle too. I know that from talking with hitters that they just weren't accustomed, especially left-handed hitters, to seeing someone throw from that angle. And certainly the fear was underscored by that great moment during the All-Star game in Camden Yards when you threw the ball over Krucky's head. And I was curious when you came up with that idea to do that.
That wasn't an idea.
You're kidding. I always thought it was a setup.
No, that was something that could probably happen on a little bit more of a regular basis when I was in the minor leagues or even early in Seattle where I hadn't harnessed my mechanics or my control yet. So I could, you know, throw a ball to the backstop and, you know, it just happened. Or I could throw a fastball into the, you know, 55 feet, you know, just mechanically, I wasn't there yet. But in that particular All-Star game, that was something I remember it pretty vividly that, you know, it was an extremely humid evening in Baltimore, and it was just simply a pitch that got away and then everything else that followed just kind of fell in place. It all started with the hitter that I was facing, John Kruk. I mean, any other hitter may not have played it off as humorous as John Kruk did. And the way everything, the sequence of pitches to follow after that pitch, and then his reaction to those pitches, I think that's what made it funny and part of a highlight of that All-Star game and All-Star games that followed. They still show that. But that was nothing that was, you know, planned out. Hey, when I get in the game, I'm just going to launch a ball over someone's head and then I'm going to follow up with a couple of sliders and they're going to swing like that. I mean, you honestly watch that at bat and, I mean, you know, he was a great hitter, and he, you know, didn't want to be embarrassed, and I didn't try to do that. After I launched the pitch like that, I was just trying to, you know, throw the pitches that I was being asked to throw and throw them effectively, and I was able to do that, and that's why I just said the sequence, everything just fell in place. Now, I will say, having known Larry Walker in the minor leagues with Montreal, there was another All-Star game a few years after the Baltimore game, and I think he may have been playing. Obviously, he was playing. I don't know what team I was on then, but he came up to me, and obviously he was on in the other division, and he goes, "Hey, what are we doing?" And so if you watch that All-Star highlight, you know, I threw a pitch over his head. He started off in the left side of the on-bat on the plate, and then I threw a ball over his head, kind of like the John Kruk, and then he turned his batting helmet around, and then so that was more of a playful kind of thing that was kind of planned out. But the John Kruk was much like the bird; that was never planned either.
Wow, Randy, I got to tell you that you're right. Maybe because Krucky played it off so well that I just assumed that you were having fun and knowing, you know, the nervousness and the moment that you just said, yeah, throw it against the backstop and everyone will have some fun with that because of the.
Well, I had fun, but I mean, I'm not that good of a pitcher that I can throw a, you know, a ball over his head like that and then throw three effective sliders to a 300 hitter, let alone an all-star that year. And get him to look like that. You know what I mean? It was just everything kind of fell into place, and it was humorous, and he played it off, and I played it off, and that was a true highlight. There was no planning of anything like that before the game. You know, I didn't meet up with him, before the game and said, hey, you're the chosen one. I'm going to throw a ball over your head or anything like that. It just went over really humorously. And to this day, it's still fun to watch.
Yeah. And did you ever, what do you remember about your first conversation with Krucky after that?
Well, I think he probably got asked about it more than I did. And I wouldn't run into him that much. I think he was playing with, I believe it was Philadelphia, and I was with the Seattle Mariners then. Obviously, it was in 93, so I was with Seattle, but I believe he was with Philadelphia. You know, we didn't cross paths very much, so I think that was another reason why it was pretty humorous to be able to face people from the National League that you don't get that opportunity. You only hear about their greatness or see it on highlights or on TV, but you didn't get to actually face them that much until interleague play got into the game. And, you know, I think it worked very much both ways. I definitely knew the caliber of hitter he was. And I'm assuming that he might have known that I was a power pitcher and a little wild back then, and being a left-handed hitter as well. I think that's one reason that most left-handed hitters initially were a little worried about getting in the batter's box against me, having a three-quarter release and then throwing, being a power pitcher, and then obviously initially not having much control. You know, all those intangibles, I think, you know, you'd probably rather be a right-handed hitter facing me than seeing the ball come out of almost where the second baseman is almost fielding from.
Oh, 100%. And I know what teams I covered, the left-handed hitters, the day you pitched, they took the day off or they were given the day off. And I'm curious about who is a left-handed hitter who you could see was digging in and saying, you know what, I love this challenge.
I don't think there was anybody that just bailed. I think anybody that was in the lineup that day, you know, there was no easy outs. And I think later in my career, early in my career, I never thought about what we're talking about now. Later in my career, I started hearing about, you know, the best hitters on the team, the opposing team, were usually left-handed hitters, or at least a couple of them. And when they weren't starting to play, I would understand why they weren't. And so, you know, I felt like, well, now it's a great deal of responsibility that when I'm out there pitching and a left-handed hitter is playing, it was almost like it was playing into my hands too, that I do need to concentrate a little bit more on getting them out, because as soon as they get a hit off me, then they feel like, well, it wasn't that hard, or, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I don't know. You know, so making it a little bit tougher on a left-handed hitter, I gave up my share of hits, obviously, but I just feel like if you're going to already be somewhat intimidated by being in the lineup, and then eventually you are going to be in the lineup, then I probably got to do my part in reassuring you that maybe, you know, it's going to be a really tough at bat. So I almost played into that as well after a while. But I mean, you know, there's, you know, John Olerud, I faced, he hit a home run off me. You know, I enjoyed facing Don Mattingly. You know, we talked about baseball a little bit over the years when I played with the Yankees and he was there. We would talk a little bit about it. And, you know, to me, the best hitters in my generation, if you think about it, the best hitters in my generation from 1989 to 2009, the best hitters in that era were left-handed hitters. Think about it.
Oh, yeah.
King Griffey Jr., Barry Bonds, Wade Boggs, George Brett, Don Mattingly.
Tony Gwynn.
Tony Gwynn. Yes, Tony Gwynn. And I love facing him. My God, what a privilege it truly was. What a privilege it was to face these people. They're the best. You can see where I'm coming from. The best hitters in the game, you know, were left-handed in my eyes. I mean, yeah, you had Frank Thomas and people like that. I understand he's right-handed, but a majority of the best hitters in my era were left-handed. And I got to face them early in my career. And then after a while, you know, maybe it was because I was able to harness my ability and made things a little bit more difficult for them based on my pitching ability. But early on, I think they were just worried about facing me and getting hit. Not finishing up a pitch to a left-handed hitter meant that the ball was going to go over your head or you were going to get hit. If I didn't finish up a pitch, you know, it was most likely going to be up and away, and that's to a left-handed hitter. I remember pitching in Fenway, a day game there, and I threw a fastball, and Mike Greenwell, another great left-handed hitter, I ended up hitting him in the head. And obviously it's not on purpose, but if you're a left-handed pitcher and you're facing a left-handed hitter and I'm 6'10" and I don't get the ball down in the zone, the ball's going to be up and away. And if the ball's up and away and you're a left-handed hitter, the ball's going to be coming at you. And I think that was the reason why some left-handed hitters were a little worried about that particular scenario. And anyways, I hit Mike Greenwell. You know, the fans weren't too happy about that, and I could completely understand that. But that was a situation where, you know, after it happened, I went to home plate and made sure that he was okay. And I'm not out there to, you know, he's out there to make a living for his family, and I'm not out there surely to hurt him by any means. But that was something that I understood right away, that if I don't finish up my pitches to a left-handed hitter, that could be the outcome. And I think that was one reason why left-handed hitters, you know, like you said, the arm angle, the slider, the inability to be able to pick up the ball, like maybe a right-hander can a little bit faster, and the release point, you know, all works to the disadvantage to a left-handed hitter. With that all being said, if you're a left-handed hitter and you like the challenge, and all of a sudden you do have some hits off me, then you've enjoyed that challenge. You've been successful at it. And, you know, it's not that big of a deal to you. You don't know why everybody's making it such a big deal. You know, I just felt like, you know, I would play into that quite a bit too. And just trying to make it a little bit more difficult, but there was definitely left-handed hitters that fared pretty well off of me, just like there was right-handed hitters.
You've had so many signature moments in your career that, you know, the Kruk moment, the 2001 World Series, the perfect game. And you mentioned the bird. And I'm curious, just that knowing how fans are, when you bump into fans, you're signing autographs. What's the play or the moment that everybody asks you about?
The bird.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's what bird. I was going to guess.
Yeah. Well, because that is I don't think there was. I don't think there was too many things like that scenario that were captured on film that people could actually see. there may have been things, you know, it's like that, you know, you have to see it to believe it. And, you know, it was lucky to be captured on film. And the only reason it was is because it was just one of our camera guys, small little video camcorders out there in center field for pitchers like myself or our hitters to watch video. You know, that was back in 2001, I think. So, you know, that kind of resource was kind of up and coming with the video rooms and all the technology and all that. But the only reason that situation got captured was just simply because our camera guy had a little camcorder out there. If not, the only people that obviously would have witnessed it would have been the players and the fans there. But, you know, it kind of was captured and blew up with everybody seeing that. And then I think it's happened a few times after that in different ways, maybe. But that is definitely the one thing that people, you know, see the most. Because there can be people that weren't even born when that happened. And they obviously, someone has showed them that situation. So it's a situation that I probably react to that situation like John Kruk reacted to the situation of me throwing that ball over his head. He got kind of tired of talking about it. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. Let me ask you about the 2001 World Series, Game 6 and 7, which, again, I you know, for me personally, that will really define you in terms of what you were as a pitcher in your career. In Game 6, 7 innings, 2 runs, you guys win to even the series at 3-all. And the next night, you know, I can't remember anyone talking about, well, there's a possibility Randy Johnson could pitch out of the bullpen in Game 7 the very next day. When did that become a possibility in your mind?
Well, it was the farthest thing from my mind too. I mean, you know, pitching the must win game of Game 6, coming back from New York, being down now 3-2 and having to win Game 6. You know, we had a sizable lead in that game. So I was able to pitch 7 innings, I believe, and leave the game with a pretty good sized lead. But before coming out of the game, Bob Brenly asked that if I were to come out of the game now, would I be available to pitch if needed in Game 7? And, you know, I'm not going to say no.
Right.
I don't know how that year I'd already pitched, like, you know, the regular season, 230 innings. And, you know, I pitched the most in that postseason. So, you know, I was pretty gassed by the time Game 6 came around. But, you know, I'm not going to say no and don't know what I would have left in the tank the next day. But, you know, in those situations, adrenaline pretty much takes over. And MLB Channel recently showed Game 7, and I ended up watching the last couple innings of that just to kind of remember how everything kind of developed. And you tend to, you know, over that many years, you tend to kind of forget how everything kind of went down. And so it was kind of interesting to watch that. But I think coming out of the bullpen after throwing all the innings and all the pitches that I did that year, it was just sheer adrenaline that took over. And one of the greatest moments of my career, considering you know, you play baseball to go to a World Series and win one, just like if you're a football player going to the Super Bowl and celebrating. You know, I'm fortunate enough to play 22 years and I only got to one World Series. So I'm thankful that that the one World Series was successful and it was memorable. And in the town that actually the city that I still live in, which, you know, Arizona is my home. And so I'm thankful that it all kind of came into all kind of dropped into place. So,
and you got the win in Game 2, you got the win in Game 6, and then you get the win in Game 7 after you guys come back in the ninth inning against Mariano Rivera. Luis Gonzalez getting the walk-off hit. Curt Schilling told me that when Alfonso Soriano hit the home run to give the Yankees the lead 2-1, that the ball was in the air and soaring toward left center field, and it popped into his mind, oh, my God, Rivera's coming into the game. And that moment, he thought, oh, that's it. Like, Rivera's coming in. Tell me what was going through your mind when you saw that.
I probably, along with everybody else, I don't know how many people were at that game, you know, and, you know, 48, 49,000 people and all the millions of people that were watching the game on TV around the world. That was probably, whether you were rooting for us or against us, that is probably the same thing that everybody else was saying as well. He's probably the only player in the game that you would probably the only closer in my generation, once again, that had that kind of aura about him, that if you were losing the game and you were in the seventh or eighth inning, you knew that, you know, he was down there and it was going to be a really tough task at hand to overcome that. And, you know, I probably was down in the bullpen, not warming up yet, because I think Soriano hit the home run in about the seventh inning to take the lead.
Yep.
But I think I was down in the bullpen. But I kind of thought the same thing. I also thought that even more so. That crossed my mind even more so when I was walking off the mound in the top of the ninth. I had come in and pitched it to a batter or two in the top of the eighth. But after I completed the top of the ninth and we were still losing 2-1, walking off the mound, you know, essentially having a flashback of the whole year that we had, how amazing the run was that we had, and you know, beating Atlanta to get to the World Series and getting through St. Louis, I believe it was, and then, you know, how magical it was in Game One and Game Two at home, winning those games and winning or being in the lead in Game 3, 4, and 5 in New York, and now, you know, it could have easily been we could have easily swept the World Series, but now we're actually on the verge of losing, walking off the mound. That's not insurmountable, you know, way of thinking about it, you know, thinking about how great the World Series was. You know, this could have been ours, but, you know, everybody has their day, and one reason why I was happy to be able to watch the bottom of the ninth inning is just to recall how everything kind of developed with a base hit here and a botched bunt play, throw to second base, and then a hit, you know, Craig Counsell getting hit in the hand, and so how the whole thing just kind of developed. You kind of forget how everybody just remembers the outcome, the infield playing in and Gonzo getting the base hit over Jeter's head, but you kind of forget about how that whole inning just kind of develops, because that doesn't happen very often to Mariano Rivera when he has a lead. It's usually 1-2-3, but it was pretty magical to see all that happen.
I've asked players, like I talked to David Freese about Game 6 of 2011, and he has absolute total recall of the moment when, you know, his triple goes over Nelson Cruz's head, when his home run walk off. He still remembers that. And on the other hand, I talked to Aaron Boone about his home run, and he can't remember any of it. In that moment when you see Luis Gonzalez's hit fall in, tell me from that point forward, what do you remember?
It's just a blur, truly. I mean, you know, that was 19 years ago. And to try to remember the details now, you know, that was 2001. And then I went on and played 8 more years. So I didn't make any more World Series memories, and then being retired for 11 years, just kind of hard to remember how everything kind of, you just remember the highlights and the lowlights of games. You don't remember how everything kind of develops, you know, from the first inning to the ninth. Some people can recall all that. For me, I can't. It was all just a bit of a blur. It was just an amazing run. And then you think about how some players have been fortunate enough to have that feeling multiple times. And then to think on the other hand, there's players in the Hall of Fame and great players that have never had that feeling of getting to a World Series. And that's truly as a little boy, when you're playing baseball and little league and all these kind of things, stick ball and all the wiffle ball and all that, the scenarios in your backyard are always, you know, game seven World Series and all that. And then when you're actually in a game seven and you're walking off the mound and you're playing against the greatest dynasty of any sport, you're always supposed to be thinking positive for sure. And you don't have to tell me that, but you know, the glimmer of not thinking positive, you know, creeps in there. You're losing. It's game seven. There is no more tomorrow. We're three outs away from losing, and we're going against not even arguably. There is no argument. He's the greatest closer of all time, you know, Mariano Rivera. So it's okay in the back of your head if you're thinking, wow, you know, how can this happen? It's like everything was going our way, and then all of a sudden it just turned. But then for every moment that you think that, there's someone, you know, on the other shoulder, you know, you got the negative person on one side of your shoulder, then you got the angel on your other shoulder saying, this game's not over till it's over.
Oh, 100%. Yeah, 100%. I told friends when I worked on a book on that, on game seven, I told friends, you know, at the end of that World Series, you guys dominated 95 to 96% of that World Series. And yet there the Yankees were three outs away. It was crazy.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, you know, that's what I'm saying. I mean, theoretically, you know, we leave Arizona being up 2-0. We're leading games three and game four and game five late in the game. I mean, we lost those leads, I believe, late in the game with our closer, Byung-Young Kim, if you recall. And that's why it was so rewarding when we did win. Everybody was looking for him, you know, to hug him and, you know, it's definitely, that's one reason why it's a team game. We got there because of all the games he saved. But looking at, you know, we could have easily swept the Yankees and, you know, and now we are walking off the mound and you're thinking, well, my God, we went from, you know, having such a great year and possibly, you know, sweeping the Yankees to losing now. So anybody that was thinking, you know, it was in the bag, you know, had it was okay to think that for a split second, because you have every right to think that, because you have the greatest closer of all time that's coming in, that's proven in those situations, that has not failed those situations very often. And so if you're thinking we have very little chance, if you say very little, well, the door's not closed all the way. And like I said, we chipped away and things happened. And the next minute you're going from how are we going to overcome this to it happened so quick that we're dogpiling on the pitcher's mound. And I'm sure there's other players that have had that comeback scenario in the World Series. And they know exactly what I'm explaining.
Absolutely. Randy, I appreciate you taking the time to help distract us during this time.
Well, I think it's a great distraction talking baseball. And I know in 2001 that's exactly what I think it was during 9/11 was a distraction for people to get their minds off of everything at that time. And I think, you know, where we're at, in 2020, under these circumstances, I think it's going to, you know, it's going to be a little different than that. You know, this is something that now, I guess, for a while they were talking about fans not even being able to come to the ballpark. And that's how different this situation is from something else that, you know, probably the last thing that baseball went through was 2001. And so now we're trying to baseball's trying to tackle this situation and find out when and how baseball will play a role in the recovery of our country and in the world.
100%. I agree with you. Thank you, Randy.
My pleasure. Thank you, Buster. I appreciate it.
Todd Radom is the chief executive of our weekly quiz. He's a graphic artist whose work can be seen on ball fields all around America, all across the world. Or you can go to his website, toddradom.com. Todd, how you doing?
I'm doing all right, Buster. We are healthy here and hanging out, and hope the same applies to everyone out there.
Yeah, you and I live about, 10 miles apart or so, and it feels like about 6,000 here in New York when we're locked down the way that we are. So we just got done talking with Randy Johnson, and I got to tell you, I wanted to ask him about that moment in the All-Star game at Camden Yards when he threw the ball over John Kruk's head. And I always had the belief in my heart, in my mind, that that was a goof. Like, Randy made up his mind beforehand, you know what, it's the All-Star game, it's fun, it's exhibition game, I'm going to throw the ball over his head and all the way to the backstop on purpose. And I learned it wasn't a goof.
Wow.
That surprised me. Like, that was legitimately, and now you can understand why John Kruk was so frightened, for lack of a better way to describe it.
Holy smokes. In an All-Star game, which, let's frame this, there were several years when they used the expression, this time it counts. That was well before then. So I'm a little bit surprised.
Well, he made it clear. The pitch got away from him. It wasn't like he was trying to scare him. But just assumed all these years that had to have been put on, right? Because of Randy's reputation is intimidating, 6'10" left-hander, throw the ball to the backstop, everyone has a laugh. But it's pretty clear that, as we talked about, like, John Kruk's reaction to it, sort of he played it off brilliantly.
Well, I remember watching that on TV. That was one of the last ones I was not actually at. And I learned something today. And these days, if you learn something on a, it's a big accomplishment for the day. So that's good.
Very nice. All right. Before we get to the weekly quiz, we're taking our tour of ballparks all around America. And this week, we're going to stop in San Diego, my old stomping grounds. And we're going to talk about Petco Park, which it's one of my favorite parks.
I love it there, Buster. We've had a run of good ballparks that we've been talking about. Pretty soon we're going to get to clunkers at some point. But I love Petco Park, too. There's nothing not to like about San Diego. I think when you look at these ballparks, and we've had enough of these discussions now that we've got some momentum, you look for unique features that aren't necessarily gimmicky. I love the Western Metal Supply building out in left field. I love the fact that there's a foul pole painted on the building itself. I will say I have sat all over that ballpark. I sat in some seats that they called the point. So there are these bar stools out in left field, left center field, overlooking the expanse there. And they are just spectacular. You get one of those good San Diego craft beers and all that beautiful weather, and you're right there. And to me, it's amazing. The neighborhood around it has exploded since this ballpark opened. There's nothing bad you could say about San Diego. There's nothing bad you could say about Petco Park.
No, I 100% agree with what you're saying. I love the fact that it's down by the water. The natural place to build this ballpark, as you know, the old ballpark, which I'll always refer to Jack Murphy Stadium, you might call Qualcomm Park or Stadium or whatever it was called. It was Jack Murphy, okay? Because he was a sports writer in San Diego, who was so instrumental to sports in that town. He used to work at the same newspaper I did, at the San Diego Union. That park is the one I worked in. It's near and dear to my heart. And what I'll never forget about it, Jack Murphy Stadium was constructed down in Mission Valley, where there used to be a river that would run through that, and there was wildlife everywhere. And that included after games. Especially in the 2 years I covered the team, the Padres were not very good. And so the animals seemed to be very comfortable coming into the ballpark because there usually wasn't anybody there. and after games, people that the scant number of fans who did come would leave their popcorn and all the tortilla chips, all the little goodies that were there, fish tacos, in San Diego. And these animals would feast. In the 2 years I covered the team, I saw running through the stands after games, fox, We saw lots of skunks. In fact, there's a famous video of the New York Mets players being chased out of the visiting dugout by the appearance of a skunk. Coyotes. I saw one time an owl like swooping down and after the game. It was it wasn't the San Diego Zoo, Todd, but it kind of was.
National Geographic meets the National League West, Buster. That's it. I had no idea. That's amazing. My memory of that ballpark, I only went there once, and it was a game in August 2002 with a couple of buddies. We went to a rather meaningless Padres-Phillies game, and we came down from Orange County. Guys I went with lived up there, and, you know, traffic can be not so hot on the 5, right? But this game is just cruising along. We're in the 6th inning. It's been an hour or something. It's like, holy smokes, we're going to get home. You know, it's a weeknight at a reasonable hour. Things get stalled. Long story short, a couple of things. The game wound up going 16 innings. So wow. We stayed for the entire game. It ended at, you know, God knows when, a little bit after midnight. I saw a couple of things. That ballpark, of course, emptied out along the way. We moved down in our seats. There's nobody there. It's the 15th inning or so. A foul ball, we're in left field, down toward the field. A foul ball comes looping over our heads. It takes one bounce. I look behind me. There's a woman nursing a baby standing up over by the portal that leads into the hallway there. The baby in one arm, the ball takes one bounce. She catches it with her other hand. Didn't have to move a quarter of an inch. And, yeah, it was that kind of game.
A lot of skill there in San Diego, a lot of baseball. That's awesome. I would say this about the Murph. There wasn't anything that really jumps out in terms of the ballpark itself. I mean, I'll always enjoy it because, I got to work there. In fact, I my last year I was in San Diego, I rented an apartment, which literally was the closest apartment to Jack Murphy Stadium. And it took me about 90 seconds to drive from that over to the ballpark. But the ballpark itself was just kind of a multi-purpose stadium under the sun.
Yeah, I just remember those big looping spirals that got you out of there. Kind of looked like, in that sense, kind of like giant stadium in the Meadowlands. But yeah, beautiful setting, though, and wildlife, which you really can't beat. Buster, you never walked to the ballpark because, what, you were afraid of being attacked by a fox or some bears or something?
Or people. It was not a great area for that, Todd. Yeah, I'm walking back at 1 o'clock in the morning in that area. Yeah, probably wouldn't have been a good idea. All right, let's get to this week's quiz.
All right, here we go, guys. What was the last MLB franchise to regularly wear pullover jerseys? No buttons. Was it the Reds, the Pirates, the Expos, or the Indians? 162 games a year we're talking. No buttons. Reds, Pirates, Expos, Indians. Let's go.
All right, Taylor.
Let's go Expos for no reason in particular.
I am going to go – I'm going to go Indians, and I have a particular image in mind, which is I remember Corey Snyder on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I think that was when they still wore them. What do you got, Todd?
Well, you're both wrong, and Buster, you're especially wrong because those were button-ups. Those are 1980s. Two things. The Cincinnati Reds would be the correct answer. The Cincinnati Reds, of all teams, 1992, wore pullovers. Remember the 90 World Series? And Taylor, to your point, the Montreal Expos, shockingly, never wore buttons. For a team with kind of, I don't know if they were outlandish, but colorful uniforms, they were pretty traditional in that sense. So you're both losers. You're both wrong.
Go Reds.
But you know what? We both have lots of time to prepare for next week's quiz.
Absolutely. Start studying.
Oh, my goodness. All right, Todd. Thanks for doing this. And thanks for allowing me to go down memory lane with the San Diego Zoo South at Jack Murphy.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.
Here's Tim Kirchens, Daily Baseball Fix. This about Hall of Famer Frank Robinson.
On this date, Frank Robinson made his major league debut. He is the most ferocious player I've ever seen wear a major league uniform. He won the Triple Crown, is the only player to win the MVP in both leagues. And when he was traded to the Orioles in 1966, Brooks Robinson told me, "Frank, taught us how to win. On opening day 1975, he became the first African-American to manage in the major leagues. He was a player manager, but he didn't put himself in the lineup that day until Phil Seggie, his GM, came over and said, "Frank, you have to play today. This is your day." So Robinson did, and in the first inning, batting second, he gets behind 0-2 to Doc Medich. Medich then throws a nasty slider off the outside part of the plate, and Frank Robinson goes, "This guy's trying to strike me out on three pitches. He's trying to embarrass me on my day. Nobody does that to me." And then Frank Robinson hit a home run over the left center field fence. And that is Frank Robinson.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Friday. Real quick, though, before we get to the tweets, I want to remind everyone this Sunday, tune in to The Last Dance, a behind-the-scenes look at the 90s Chicago Bulls dynasty. The series starts this Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern on ESPN, and listen to the wrap-up podcast hosted by Jalen and Jacoby immediately following the broadcast. That is presented by our friends at State Farm and AT&T. You can find that podcast wherever you enjoy your podcast. I'm extremely excited about this. I'll be watching on Sunday night. For certain. Are you going to watch, Buster, or is this?
Heck yeah.
I feel like you're very much like a straight and narrow baseball guy.
No. I covered everything. Heck yeah. And Michael Jordan and I share the same birthday. We were in college at the same time. Very much aware. And also, one of his teammates that he yelled at and apparently punched at some point was someone who I graduated with in the same year, Will Perdue. We went to Vanderbilt at the same time, and Will and I have talked about that. That surprises me. You thought I was a baseball only guy because I love a lot of sports, and I can't wait for that on Sunday.
I learn something new about you every day, Buster. I apologize if I offended your sensibilities there. Let's get to the tweets. Aaron at AARon San Diego writes in, "What is Major League Baseball doing in terms of communicating with players are hoping for? We've heard lots of complaints about the proposals, but is there any conversation between the parties on how to improve the proposals?"
Yes, there is. There are a lot of conversations going on. The Player Association also updates the players on them. Sometimes the players do learn from the media what some of the details are, and they have to address some of these. But I'll say it again. I just feel like that just more information needs to be developed about the fight against the coronavirus before you're going to get buy-in from players, no matter what the details are.
This is just kind of backing on that myself. Could you see a scenario where it's like, you know, you're welcome to join us, you don't have to, so we're going to fill out the rest of the roster with, you know, minor league guys and free agents? Could you see a scenario like that playing out if they do,
yes,
you know, go through with this?
Yes, I do. And they're not close to doing it. But right, if they ever did get to that point where they were going to, you know, play games in empty ballparks and keep the players away from their families for 4.5 months, I think there would be a number of players who would not participate.
Interesting. PK Steinberg writes in, "As you're someone who travels a lot normally, are you finding it hard to stay in one place, or is it actually a relief?"
PK, I'll echo what Mike Messina told us earlier this week, that, you know, he jokingly said that he invented social distancing because he lives on a mountain in the middle of Pennsylvania. I kind of feel like I was trained perfectly for social distancing growing up at a farm in the middle of nowhere in Vermont. The nearest house to our house was a mile away. But beyond that, you know, I just want everyone to be better. You know, I just want everyone to feel better. So it feels like every day when you get up, you're just like, okay, I'm going to do the right thing today. I'm going to keep my distance from people, including my next door neighbors who are like grandparents to my kids.
As Marley said with us, you know, no real problems as long as you're safe and healthy.
Yep.
Last one for today. Mike Atkinson at Kinson Mike PR. "I recently read Joey Gallo had something like 1,337 plate appearances before he hit a sac fly in 2019. Do you have a favorite strange baseball statistic?"
Yes. And I might have the number wrong, but it's very close to being right at the very least. I think I read that Joey Votto in the course of his career has hit foul pop-up to a first baseman, which tells you something about the precision and the excellence of Joey Votto's swing. It's a remarkable statistic that he just doesn't hit pop-ups. Back in the day, Wade Boggs used to be the same way, that he hit so many line drives, he just wouldn't hit pop-ups, and Joey Votto's the same way.
Good stuff, Buster. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review to this podcast. We got a bunch of good stuff coming up next week. And a quick apology to the listeners yesterday. I was kind of on autopilot. My filing systems for all my podcasts that I produce all the same dropped the wrong episode in. So here I am opening myself to, a public flogging in the town square.
Or social media flogging, right? Which is probably feels worse at times. But no, it's all good. And what a great week we had. Hall of Famers. Right from the get-go, Johnny Bench, Mike Messina, Jim Palmer, George Brett, Randy Johnson. Next week, it's going to be General Manager Week, and we're going to lead off with Hall of Fame General Manager Pat Gillick, who's got backstories on some of the biggest deals he made and about Ichiro. A lot of fun. We'll be talking with other general managers as well. Have a great weekend, everybody. Thanks for listening, and stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.